You are listening to Service Course by The Cycling Podcast with Lizzie Banks and Tom Whalley.
Well, Lizzie, I always ask this. Where are we? I can see where you are, actually. I don't even need to ask you. You are in your living room with a beautiful cat.
Yeah, Delia's doing a great job of being third co-presenter, secondary producer today, chief snorer. She was actually licking her paws very aggressively, which may or may not make it onto today's recording.
Is this part of your sort of warm down routine after you get in from a hard ride? I know you've done about 4 hours today. So is it, you know, refuel and then cat?
Refuel, then a little stretch, usually a bit of a downward facing dog, sometimes with the addition of a downward facing cat. And then just chill out on the sofa, watch some TV, hug the cat, tell the cat how beautiful it is. You know the drill.
Well, I wanted to start, before we get into the meat of this episode, I want to start with a quick news roundup. A couple of bits, not necessarily techie, but we'd be remiss not to mention that your team, Lizzie, has a new sponsor.
It's really exciting. We have a new sponsor until December 2024, which is Polcat, which is a French couture fashion house. And actually, if you listen to this week's episode of Cycling Podcast Féminin, there's a really good interview with my team director and the director of Polcat as well. So listen to that to find out all the latest info.
I mean, it really is amazing news. You know, at a time when I thought teams might struggle, to have a new sponsor coming in, save the team, it's fantastic. You must be pinching yourself, Lizzie. You must be so happy about it.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I can't really believe it. And of course, it's wonderful news. But in other ways, I'm not surprised because women's cycling is an amazing investment. You know, if you take the salary of one male rider and you take a third of that, you can run a whole top-tier women's cycling team. And why wouldn't you? I mean, I think it's so great to be that we're partnering up with Polcat because they are two brands that actually align really well. You know, we have really, really strong women representing the brand. And I think we can create something really, really exciting together. And I think it can be a really fruitful partnership.
Well, basically, most of my news roundup, Lizzie, this week actually consists of stuff that you've been doing or is linked back to you, to be honest. So the second thing I wanted to talk about was the Skoda V Women's Tour, which was I think it's probably the first televised, or certainly on the BBC, virtual race, or women's virtual race, definitely.
It's the first race that has had a V race or an E race in place of the normal race at pretty much the same time. Yeah, I'm fresh from the hurt box from that. That was 3 days of pretty full-on racing, and it was fun. I have to say I did have my reservations about it beforehand. I wasn't really sure if I would enjoy it. Then we did the test race, and I won it, and I thought, okay, right, yeah, I'm going to give this a go. And then we got into the real race, and it was fun, but I think there were a few problems with some technical glitches, which, to be honest, that cast a little bit of a shadow over the race for me, unfortunately. And actually, this is something that we do want to talk about in the future. We get a lot of emails from you guys saying, please talk about something else other than Zwift. And you guys are right. There are a lot of other platforms out there, and there are a lot of other really good alternatives. And actually, I think RGT is a fantastic platform. I think it has amazing potential, but I think maybe it's not quite ready for kind of live televised professional racing. But yeah, I mean, stay tuned, because in the winter, this is something that we're going to cover, and we're going to look at kind of all of the ranges and the different options for indoor training.
Well, I mean, just as a punter, I mean, I only saw the third stage, which is when I was expecting you to win the race overall, Lizzie, but a little glitch meant that you didn't fulfil that dream of mine. But watching it as a punter, I've got to say, I've watched a lot of Zwift races, and sometimes it's a little bit, I don't know, weirdly uncanny, and I don't find myself as involved in it as I do when I'm watching real racing. When I was watching this racing, I said to you before we started recording, there was one moment where there was about to be, and there was, a touch of wheels, and I had an intake of breath. I was actually like, oh no, crash is going to happen. On a virtual platform, it really drew me in. I was really impressed by it, and I thought, even just as a backdrop to discuss, as they were doing on the BBC, like to discuss the wider issues of this season and of V racing, I thought it was fantastic. I mean, you were too far in the hurt locker to appreciate that, I guess.
No, I do actually agree with you completely. And I have to say, I completely got that race feeling. I was really nervous for, you know, an hour and a half before on the start line. I felt like I was on the start line of a race, and I was completely drawn into the race. I was really in the moment, watching people attack, trying to go on the wheels. And you still had that kind of mental game that you do in real racing. If somebody had gone up the hill and was ahead of you, oh, can I catch them? Are they fine? Of course, they're actually suffering just the same as you are, but of course you can't see them like you can in real life. So I think that aspect and kind of the mental aspect of it was really, really interesting for me. And when I did have a glitch and my avatar froze a little bit in the third stage, I went with the attitude that, well, I'm not going to give up. I just time trialed my way to the finish, and I think it was average 300 watts for 52 minutes or something. So it was savage, and I was in my dining room absolutely pouring. My husband was stuffing the ice packs down my neck. But no, it was a really good experience, and I have to say it was much more lifelike than I thought it would be.
Well, let's talk numbers, actually, because I saw some of the power numbers that you posted on Instagram. Did you surprise yourself with those? I mean, what was your average power, did you say, for the third stage?
Well, actually, you have two power meters when you're doing this kind of race, because you actually have your trainer power and your power meter power. So they were about 10 watts out, but my power meter power average something like 292 and normalized 302 or something. But then obviously that's not a smooth power, you know, there's a lot of spikes in that. So yeah, it was pretty hard and pretty hot.
But did you surprise yourself with those numbers? I mean, it's been so long without, you know, racing. Were you surprised at all?
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised because it's you know, I haven't done a kind of like 55 minute all out effort for quite a while. So, yeah. I mean, obviously I have still been training and I have still been doing intensity, but not quite like that. So, no, it was pleasing. I'm definitely on the right track, you know. We're due to start racing in another month's time, which is a bit weird, seeing as, you know, I've not been on a bike ride with anybody other than my husband for 4 months. But the form's there, the fitness is there, and I just got one more kilo of lockdown cake weight to shift, and yeah, I'm ready to rock and roll.
Okay, well, the final bit of news for the news roundup, this doesn't involve you, Lizzie, but I picked this one up, and it was Absolute Black have launched a chain lube that uses graphene, and it only costs $150 a bottle.
Absolute bargain.
But as soon as that popped up on my Google Alerts, I wanted to know more. And back in December, we did a special episode dedicated to graphene. And one of the voices you heard in that was Adrian Nixon, who edits and publishes the Nixine Journal, which covers innovations in the field of graphene. He's a lovely man. And so I got in touch straight away to ask him to take a look at the product and tell me about the science behind it.
So, Adrian, last time we met, we talked about graphene products and you showed me some amazing things. And there are some graphene products that are true graphene products, and there are some that are graphite products but just badged up. This, which camp does this one sit in?
Definitely graphene. I was quite surprised. I expected it to be graphite dressed up as graphene, because you get a lot of that at the moment with all the hype that's going on, but these guys have done the proper science. So what it is, Absolute Black have developed, they've looked into this, they've tried putting graphite onto lubricant for bicycle chains, and they've found that as the moisture increases, what happens is the graphite stops acting as a lubricant, when it gets drier, it stops acting as a lubricant, so the moisture in the air actually helps it. So this is the reason they went to graphene. So the problem is you can't just dust graphene onto something and expect it to work. They put in a huge amount of effort. And since you raised this piece of technology, I had a look into the science behind it, which is quite good fun, actually, because it's what I do. And what they've done is they've first of all developed the graphene, and it's a mixture of crumpled graphene and non-crumpled graphene, which tells me they know the science. And what they're doing is they've put the graphene into paraffin wax, and then made a wax graphene composite. And then what they've done is they've melted the wax and then dispersed it in water. So you can imagine making a salad dressing. What they've done is they've managed to make the oil and the water mix together and then stay together, which is quite a cool trick, forming this emulsion. So what you then do is paint it onto your bicycle chain, give it all a really good clean, and paint it onto the chain and the cogs. And then the water helps the wax droplets get to where they want. You then dissolve the, evaporate the water away, and then the wax fills all the gaps and the cracks in and gets where oil can't. And because it's graphene, it, the wax and the graphene then coat the surface, the bits that oil can't reach, and they stay there in use. And it seems to work.
So, and well, when I flagged this up to you, my favourite bit about this was I flagged it up to you, and straight away you got your crack graphene team on the case.
Yes.
And you came up with, you told me that it might have a specific technology in it. And what was that technology? Because I forget.
Well, the specific technology they've got at the minute, in this particular case, it's graphene nanoplates and wax, but there is another technology that's been developed by Argonne National Laboratory in America, and our mutual friend Debbie, who's our editor in the States, tracked one of the key researchers down and found that they've got graphene nanoscrolls with nano diamonds inside. So if you can imagine, tiny nanoscopic ball bearings, and what they do is they wrap them in sheets of graphene that are equally nanoscopic, called nanoscrolls. And these then act as, I can't say miniature, because it's a thousand times smaller than microscopic at that level. And they form these ball bearings, which completely eliminate friction at, between two surfaces. It's really cool stuff.
Right, okay. So how do they make those nano diamonds then?
This has got to be the coolest job in science and technology. You get some graphite, and then you wrap it in something called trinitrotoluene, which you may or may not have heard of. Think of the initials in there, trinitrotoluene, TNT. It's explosive. So you wrap graphite in high explosive, put it in a chamber, and boom, set it off. And out comes nanodiamonds at the end of it. What a cool job that is.
Wow. Honestly, do you know what? It's such a good job that we met. Next time I get another graphene question, you know what I'm doing. I'm coming straight to you.
Ew.
Can't wait for the next graphene product. I can't wait.
We just really enjoy this stuff. It's great fun.
Blowing up graphene to create nanodiamonds. I love that, Lizzie. I really do. I can't wait for the next graphene development to pop up in my Google alert so we can get Adrian back on. But before I let Adrian go, you'll remember that he has the best business card I've ever seen. His job is a member of the board of directors for the International Space Elevator Consortium. Now, I know it's not about cycling, but I had to ask him what the latest with that was.
Oh, that, brilliant. Well, did you know I delivered a webinar about this a few weeks ago?
I did see that, yes, I did. Brilliant. I saw that.
It went down really, really well. We've sort of raised it up another level. One of the questions I asked in the webinar was, how long do you think it will be before it takes to make graphene at, let's say, a meter per minute? So was it never? Was it an hour? Was it a year? Was it 5 years? Whatever. And most of the audience guessed around about probably 5 years' time. They've actually got the speed up now on a continuous process to make graphene at that speed now. LG Electronics came out. It's not perfect quality yet. There's a long way to go before we get that. But boy, things are moving fast in that area. It's good fun.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb PK, the voice of Radio Tour, interrupting to remind me to tell you that this episode of Service Course is sponsored by Gymshark. Gymshark is a conditioning brand dedicated to creating functional training apparel, designing innovative performance technologies, and building passionate, empowered communities. Now, as a cyclist, I'm also a big fan of the gym and of particularly doing my sort of core workouts. It's something I came late to as a cyclist, and something I reckon a lot of cyclists neglect, but it had one of the biggest impacts on my performance. Once I started doing core workouts, I found that my position on the bike just felt more comfortable, particularly when you're doing sort of big time trial efforts and holding, you know, pretty uncomfortable positions. I just felt more strength everywhere. And that sort of workout has become even more important to me over the last few months when I've been stuck at home permanently during this lockdown. Now, with cycling, I've always stuck to the philosophy that if you look good, you go faster. And that is exactly the same, I think, when it comes to the gym. So I've been using a lot of Gymshark products. I've got some hoodies, a running jacket. One of my favourites at the moment, though, is the seamless leggings, the Control seamless leggings. As a cyclist, I just feel, you know, I'm always in bib shorts or bib tights, depending on the weather. And I think just working out in leggings, it's just an extension of that, really. I always feel great, particularly doing the core sort of stretches and those sort of workouts. So I'm a big, big fan of those. The good news is that Gymshark will be running a 24-hour sale on Thursday the 25th of June at 7 p.m. That's British summertime. And you can get up to 50% off selected lines. Check it out. Go to gymshark.com/thecyclingpodcast. That's gymshark.com/thecyclingpodcast. All right then, Lizzie, let's get into the reason that we are here this month. We're talking about hand-built and bespoke bikes. The reason I personally wanted to do this episode was in May, I should have been at Bespokes, which is the UK's, probably Europe's biggest hand-built bike show. And as an elder statesman of cycling, someone who's had a few bikes, the next bike I want is a custom bike. Is your bike actually a custom bike, Lizzie? Your team bike?
Well, we ride Chapter 2 bikes, and they are not custom, but they are small batch. So I think for a kind of carbon pro frame, they're about as custom as you're going to get. And it's pretty cool, actually. It's kind of like riding couture on the road, you know, riding couture rather than wearing couture. So no, it is pretty cool. And I have to say, I agree with you. After having done my research and some interviews for this episode, I would really love a custom steel bike as well in the future. I just think it's great. You can just specify everything you want and you can get everything dialed in. You don't have to have any add-ons because it's all built into the frame. I just think it's an amazing, beautifully crafted machine, and it's pretty cool. Looks really cool. Steel is real.
Well, as I said, the UK's biggest hand-built bicycle show, Bespoke, should have taken place in May. I was going to be there for this episode of the show. I was really looking forward to it, obviously, and it would have been their 10th anniversary, but obviously, like everything, it was cancelled. Bespoke was founded by Phil Taylor and his wife Tessa. Phil is actually a psychotherapist by trade, which I think is probably a pretty transferable set of skills when it comes to working with people to design their perfect bike. I spoke to him about how the idea for Bespoke came about.
I started it about 10 years ago. I was teaching at the time in Brighton and living in Worthing, and I was cycling, commuting over, and I was, rather than just always going straight backwards and forwards along the seafront, I thought it'd be nice to be able to go across the downs. And I thought, oh, I'd like to be able to have a bike that could be quite fast on the road, and but also be able to sort of take the bridleways and that across the South Downs. So I sort of thought, what I want is, I suppose it's a gravel bike now, but they weren't around then. There was a cyclocross bike. So I started thinking, oh, I could make myself a bike. Or I'd always cycled. So I came across NABS, and I'd heard of NABS. And at the time, my wife and I had set up Brighton Art Fair. So we had experience of setting up shows. So we thought, well, why don't we set up a show for people that make bikes? So that's how, Bespoke came along.
And that was 10 years ago then. So how has it changed in the 10 years since you started it?
I think when the hardest thing about the first show was pulling together the frame builders. It was quite a, there wasn't a community as such. There was the old school builders of Rourke, Swallow, people that had survived, and Roberts at the time, people that had survived from that had always been building frames. But there was also a starting up of the new school, I suppose, of Tom at Demon Frameworks. Ricky Feather had just started, Tom Don, who had just started. And it was about getting in touch with these people and, I suppose, earning their trust and confidence that, yeah, we're going to have a show, come along and see what it's like. And the first show was relatively small, still in Bristol, but at a smaller venue. And it was a success from there. There was a real keen interest among the public to meet people that make bikes. The people that make bikes, the frame builders love to show what they do. Often they spend most of their time in a workshop filing bits of metal, and they make the bike, it comes and gets picked up and it disappears off quite quickly. So to actually stand around the beautiful creations you make and talk about them to people who appreciate them. And I think it's that, the connection between those two people. It's the makers, having the makers there that have created these beautiful objects, and people that appreciate them, that make bespoke special, that both understand what's gone on and what's gone into to making the beautiful machines.
So you build them yourself. Do you build them for other people, or is that just a personal thing?
I did for a while, and that's how, going back to the beginning of the story of how Bespoke started, it was we put together the show, but at the same time I enrolled on a TIG welding class and became a qualified TIG welder with the aim of building bikes. And I, alongside setting up Bespoke, I suppose I learned, I was doing videos a bit like this podcast. I would go and see different frame builders and started up our Meet the Maker videos, and would go to different people's workshops and just have a chat with them, not necessarily sort of, just how do you do this. And every time I was building a frame, I was teaching myself in a small kind of garage type workshop I had, and I'm having difficulty with this bit, and on the whole, the community is very supportive. It's, what you want to do is you want to use a bit of this and do a bit of that. And it's, okay. So, yes, I started building them for myself and friends. And I had a company for a bit, Libertine Bicycles, which it still exists. But I just found I ran out of time to be able to dedicate to building bikes. So I organised the show and do the psychotherapy. But... I've built my own bikes, and I've built bikes for my family. In fact, I've got two to build. Well, I should be starting them anytime soon. One for my daughter, one for my brother. So it's a family affair.
So that was Phil Taylor, who co-founded Bespoke 10 years ago. The Postponed show is now currently planned for October. Now, after speaking to Phil, I wanted to find out how the COVID-19 crisis has affected frame builders. Most of them are one-woman or one-man operations, and they involve a lot of direct contact with customers. In a minute, you'll hear from a Norfolk-based builder, Duncan Crossley, who runs Crossley Metal. Before that, though, this is Liz Coleman from Beaumont Bicycle.
At the moment, I'd say it's very the same. I was just trying to think about it. I mean, I think frame building is a timeless classic. You know, it's the customer for a hand-built, made-to-measure frame, bespoke frame is somebody who is always there. You know, they don't just disappear. It's not something you decide overnight that you're going to do. It takes a long time to think about whether you're going to go for a hand-built frame, order one. And I think there is a constant craving there. And I don't think it actually changes. I think that constant craving is always there. We're making it work, really. You know, and customers I had coming for fittings, I've just had to put them on hold. But again, customers for frames are really patient people mostly, because they don't expect to have the product next day. So they tend to just be understanding. I found them being very understanding. So I've got about 5 frames that have got to be turned into bicycles. Some of them are already there, but they are in the attic, and they're just being stored because they can't come and collect. So I've got a cash flow problem, but it's eased again by very nice customers who say, well, look, let me pay the bill. And customers with orders in are saying, can I give you a cash upfront payment? Because first of all, they're worried about the Brexit thing and prices going up. Secondly, they just don't want stock to go down. And me, I don't want the stock to go, you know, tubing to go out of stock. So they're paying upfront for some of their works, which is really, really good. So it's a very, very nice, it always has been a really good business to be in, but it's never going to be a business where you earn a lot of money. you have to take some of the payment in sort of heart money, you know, that you bank it somewhere else. It's not real gold, but it's like something that you feeds your soul and makes you a better person and a happier person.
So one of the reasons I wanted to speak to you was because obviously I should have been like yourself last weekend or the weekend before. We should have been at Bespoked.
We should,
which is obviously a huge part of the calendar for frame builders in this country. Mm. I mean, how big a disappointment, how big a sort of hole is it left in this part of your year that we've not been on?
Well, it was going to be a really fantastic event for us because what I decided because of Greta and the climate situation, I decided, right, let's not take a van down and put, you know, pedal to metal going 17 miles an hour down the M5. Let's do this differently. Let's take our time and let's go over 2 days, I think we're planning to do. 2 solid days of cycling with all our stuff on a cargo bike and riding the bikes we're going to display and meeting up with our customers en route to, and then we're going to display their bikes. So it would have been amazing.
I mean, I started out doing art, you know. I went to art school, you know, at university age, kind of 18 to 21, did fine art. I did a bit of, you know, did a bit of couriering like you do in London, sort of.
Nice.
Yeah, which was all right. And then I've been a builder for a long time. So I've done, you know, custom kitchens, roofing. I do everything really, you know, all the wet stuff. Then suddenly, you know, 20, 25 years had gone by and I was like, oh my God, you know what? I never actually chose to do this. And my body's starting to suffer a little bit. You know, you spend a lot of time on your knees, don't you, doing it?
Yeah,
in trades. So a few years ago, it was funny actually, we were on the way to the national championships in Derby Cross, cyclocross.
Yeah, yeah.
Championships. And we were having a conversation about how, you know, like there were people, you know, in our country, you know, the whole face of cycling in the UK changed, didn't it, in the last 15 years?
Oh yeah, I mean, I'd say it's. Well, I mean, yeah, there's a little bit with the track, wasn't there? And then,
well,
and
I think, I mean, obviously, I think you have to, you know, you have to sort of like crown Chris Boardman and Peter Keane as the sort of the foundation stone to
Boardman,
the
Aubrey, yeah, absolutely.
Cycling, don't you? So going back to what I was saying, you know, 5 years ago, we were on the way to Derby and we were like, people are making a living out of cycling, you know, like in the UK at the moment, you know, Rafa was huge and people were doing it. There were people making frames and it was like, we should be doing something, you know. I've had enough of the building game. And we were like, I was actually just looking at doing little components, like, because we were into cross, there was always that thing with fork judder, wasn't it, with cantilever brakes. Mm. I was looking at making some, you know, like extra long cable hangers. And we were also looking at doing some little CNC bash guards, you know, so you could run, because we always used to run single rings just with 2 bash guards. But when I looked into it, there were already people doing it, you know. I was like, maybe I should just bite the bullet and just start making frames, you know. And I told her, my wife's cousin, and he was like, I'll have one. And I was like, what do you mean? He was like, yeah, what do you want? I'll pay, let's do it, let's make a frame. And I was like, oh, and that was it. So that was when I started. I don't like to repeat myself, I suppose. I think it's maybe from the artist that I've never really got that whole thing of having a style and just knocking out the same thing over and over and over again in slightly different versions. So I don't know whether it was the cleverest thing to do on a business footing, but most of the machines that I've done so far have kind of been fairly wildly different, really, you know. So I've tried to let the clients have a fairly free rein in what they want, which is like bit me in the arse a couple of times, to be honest with you. But it's been organic because it's just like, you know, I haven't not had any orders at any one time. So I kind of said, I think I'll be, you know, try making frames. And then people started buying them. So I haven't sort of, apart from going to Bespoke last year, which was a great experience. I've just been kind of, you know, tinkering away, trying to kind of perfect the craft and try and, you know, I do silver and brazing, but I also do TIG now as well. And that's been an adventure. And, you know, every machine I've done, I mean, things are changing so quickly, aren't they? You know, I did, I bought a very nice fitment for doing post mounts, and then suddenly everybody wants flat mounts on disc. And it's just like, so every time I've been making a frame, I've had to sort of, you know, relearn some things and try and run with what's going, tire clearances, you know, hydraulics, all these kind of things, trying to, you know, different painters as well. I mean, as building the brand hasn't really figured. It's just been purely about kind of addressing aesthetics and then the problems that come with that and negotiating with customers and trying to get the job done, really, which is the trickiest part when you're, you know, you've got kids, and I still do a bit of building work as well, you see, to kind of, make some money, really, because it's not been a huge earner, to be honest with you. So, I don't know. That's how, it's just happening, you know. I had a rash of kind of orders come through just before the lockdown happened. So, I mean, I've actually been all right, because I've been struggling to find the time to get to the workshop recently. My workshop's very local, so I haven't had to worry about going to work. And where I live, like, in a way, our neck of the woods almost is socially isolated. It's a small town in Norfolk. People are pretty antisocial anyway. And it's kind of been, really, my biggest problem has been childcare. You know, my son's been homeschooled by my wife, and my three-year-old daughter needs to be occupied. So I've actually been, I've actually been doing some shifts at the local bike shop on the spanner as well to earn a bit of cash. So cash flow is a problem, but the order book's full. As far as the state of the industry is concerned on my level.
I mean, are you getting new orders during this time as well?
I've had a few nibbles, you know. I've had a few nibbles just for almost like repeat custom, really. So, I mean, I haven't been making too much of an effort, just because I'm kind of a little bit behind, really. I've got four frames to build, and most of the people, the clients, have been working from home, or they're London based. So normally I would have been meeting up with them, and they would have come up and stuff. So we've had our sort of our communication wings clipped, it's kind of, everything's come to a bit of a halt. But just in the last this week, actually, I've had a couple of conversations, and you know, I think things, I'll probably have to start getting down there and getting some stuff done very soon, actually.
So it's possible. So in the current climate, then, it is possible to you know, to engage with a frame builder, even if you do it remotely, and get something built for you.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, like I said, I've done it a couple of times. The most recent one was Luca Pacenti, and you know, he's got his frame and it fits him, and he seems perfectly happy with it. I'll tell you the trickiest bit with frame building, obviously apart from the technical, you know, aspects of actually doing the business, often is the paint, and that's the bit that's going to hold me up at the moment. The painters that I'm using seem to have shut down, or they've got, you know, they've got behind, or, you know, the suppliers, they're not getting their paint. So it's this funny thing where when people have the custom frame built and they want a nice paint job, often that can be almost as much again as the frame itself. They're quite expensive, these paint jobs. So I think, you know, the spraying and how that is done, and who's doing what, and whether they're up and running at the moment, that's going to be, it's almost like the supply, the process of supply. It's like the components, maybe you can't get a certain group set, or you can't get the frame safely to the painter, or you can't actually go and, you know, it's that kind of finishing, I think, is going to be the problem. That'll be the difficult part, because I've got the stock, I can get on with it, I can make the frame, but then getting it over to the painter and then getting the client to communicate what they want with the painter and that kind of thing, is probably going to, which is always difficult anyway. So that's probably, I haven't really found a good answer to that.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Sorry to interrupt Tom and Lizzie in full flow and another enthralling episode of Service Course, but it's Richard Moore here from the other podcast, and I'm with Lionel Burney, also from the other podcast, and we're here to tell you about Babbel, who are sponsoring this episode.
Funny you should say that, Rich. Babbel is exactly what I do when I'm trying to speak a foreign language. Although this might surprise you, I did French at A-level.
You're right, that does surprise me. Well, listen, Daniel is our linguist, and it's fair to say that you and I, Lionel, remain very much on his wheel when we're in France, Spain or Italy, Germany too, if we're there, where we spend a lot of time in these countries covering the major bike races.
Yeah, I'm very envious of Daniel's ease with foreign languages, and I feel like I've built up a bit of a mental block over the years. But, Rich, you speak a fair bit of French.
A fair bit, that's very kind. Sadly, not as much as my three-year-old.
Has he been using Babbel already?
Well, he's fluent in Babbel, absolutely. Yeah. But he's also, I mean, he's fluent in as fluent as a three-year-old can be in French and English, which is impressive.
Very envious, very envious. But for the rest of us who find foreign languages a bit more of a, well, I find them a bit of a hill to get over. And I keep trying different things. And Babbel, how does it work? It teaches you through real-life conversations, and you learn through interactive dialogues. Speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent, which is definitely something that I need to work on.
Yeah, I've been doing it for a few days now. I signed up for 15-minute a day lessons, which doesn't sound like much, and it isn't, and that's what makes it quite easy. But it's quite fun as well, and it's very interactive. You can choose from 14 different languages, and the lessons have been lovingly created by over 100 language experts, real people, not machines. I've been brushing up on my French, as I mentioned, with my daily lessons. What about you, Lionel? Have you signed up as well?
I have, yeah. I'm trying to train my brain the same way I try to get fit through cycling, just through repetition and not trying to do too much and sort of burning out. So I've set between 15 and 30 minutes a day. I'm actually doing Italian because I've been doing a couple of different courses that have got me a certain way, but I think Babbel is the one to get me over the line, so I'm going to carry on and see how I get on.
Well, try Babbel today. Just go to babbel.co.uk or download the app for free. That's Babbel, BABBEL.co.uk, or download the app to try for free. Babbel, learn a new language and make it your own.
I'm only doing Italian because I just want to make this Lionel Learns Italian feature that keeps threatening to rear its head during our Giro coverage. I want to just put it to bed and never have to deal with Daniel looking at me in a funny way again.
What's Italian for put it to bed?
Haven't got to that bit yet.
Well, living in Sheffield, the steel city, of course, you would expect that there's a fair few people around who can make a cracking steel frame, and that is a really good steel frame, not a cracking one that cracks. And you'd be right. We've got Wilson Cycles, who've been here for years, making steel racing bikes in Sheffield for over 70 years. Field Cycles, who are really well known for their beautiful paint jobs. 18 Bikes, who make custom steel frames with mind-boggling pinion gearboxes, which, to be honest, is a whole show in itself. The tech is bonkers. But today I wanted to focus on a really small maker making truly beautiful and completely bespoke bikes, trikes, whatever you want them to build. So I headed down to an old steelworks, which is the home of Cycles in Motion, the bespoke workshop of Rick Bailey and Dan Smith.
This used to be I think it was a cutlery works. This was the sharpening area for knives, apparently, our little unit. So kind of has it in the walls already that born to make things in here.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool little workshop. There's a really nice setup. I mean, you could, it's kind of like a treasure trove in here. I think you could find anything you wanted to. It's really quite amazing. I wish I could invite you all in. But really, we're here today to talk about steel tubing. And I'm going to admit from the beginning, I don't really know anything about steel bikes, and I definitely don't know anything about steel tubing. So I'm hoping, Rick, that you can talk me through it.
So am I.
And, I mean, first of all, how do you choose the right bits of tubing?
Well, it depends what the customer wants, you know. The idea of a custom bike is it's purpose-built for that person and for their use. So you wouldn't use the same tubing on a mountain bike as you would a really lightweight road bike. Or you wouldn't use a, you know, if you like particularly a stiff bike, you'd use a different, you know, different chain stays or different seat stays to a bike you wanted a bit more compliance in it. So it's all about the end use of the bike and what the end user wants to use it for. And also the ride qualities they want themselves.
Okay, so what are, I mean, can you talk me through some of the different tubings that we've got here?
Yeah, and, I mean, well, this...
And what they actually are, because really...
You can see this one here is sort of a really wide tube, and it's shaped, so that's a down tube. And if you compared it to, like, another down tube... Like,
so what we've got here is kind of like, it's a round tube with...
Like a V-shaped tube.
Yeah, with a flat bit on top,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. So that's going to be a really stiff piece of tubing.
What is this?
This is Columbus tubing.
Okay.
And so you would use that on a stiff bike, like a race bike, as a down tube. Now, that might be a bit too stiff for a touring bike or like an Audax bike or something where you're doing long distance and you want a more compliant ride. So you'd use a different tubing, something slightly narrower gauge.
So is it the gauge of the tubing that gives you the stiffness, or are there more aspects?
Well, all the tubings are different alloys as well. So it's not just, steel isn't just steel. You know, steel itself is an alloy of metals. So there'll be different, you know, different amounts of chrome mixed in and, to be able to create the properties of the steel. So, and as well as the different alloys, you get butting. So a cheap steel tubing will be like plain gauge all the way through. It'll be one thickness. Where a tube like this will butt down to like 0.4 of a mil in the middle. And then it'll be slightly fatter at the ends where you weld it and join it. And the idea of that is obviously you weld it and join it and you want the stiffness up here. And then you can make it thinner in the middle for compliance. Same thing as they do on carbon frames when they lay them up. You can get a carbon frame and squeeze them in the middle there where you don't need the weight, but they're quite heavily joined and you get big bulky head tubes and bottom brackets. Same thing applies with steel. So that's one way you can sort of build a ride quality into it and save weight and essentially like build a piece of performance steel.
That's super interesting, and actually that's something I'd always wondered with an old carbon frame I've got. You know, in the top of it I can actually press it in, and I thought, oh, is this broken? But no, it's just that it doesn't need to be stiff and compliant in the top bit of the
exactly
top,
yeah you don't need the material,
not putting force there through that. It's just exactly to hold it together.
Yeah precisely. And it's the same principle with the steel tube. Like I say, you know, 0.4 of a mil thick is very, very thin, but you know, the right sort of steel alloys, it's not an issue. It doesn't move.
And is there something, I mean, when you're welding the joints together, is there a way in which you weld that can change the compliance or the stiffness or...?
Yeah, I mean, we tend to fillet braze everything here, which is essentially...
Right, Rick's actually getting out his custom hill climb bike, which we did feature back in the November episode.
So,
and he's going to show us what a fillet braze is.
A fillet braze is essentially filling the gap. As again, it's like a weld, like a TIG weld or a MIG weld, which melts the two tubes together. This melts the metal in between and sort of glues them together.
Yeah.
Now that, for using on thin tubes, is great because it helps dissipate the force. And you're not interfering with either tube. So where that joins there helps dissipate the force and spread the force into the following.
Right, and so you're not kind of changing the properties of each tube because
exactly
of the nature of the weld.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
I have to say, it looks beautiful as
it
well.
It looks beautiful and very aesthetically sort of pleasing.
Yeah, and the way you've, I don't know what the technical term is, but like, well, sanded it down at the end.
Yeah, finished it. Done a good job.
Yeah, it looks really good. And in this custom bike that Rick's built, it's not actually all steel, is it? Because you've got... an inserted carbon seat tube as well.
Yeah.
So is that something that you do a lot? You kind of insert carbon bits where customers want
it? Yeah, it's another way of just adding, you know, it's the right sort of materials for the right sort of job, really. This sort of carbon seat tube, like carbon is a great sort of
vibration dampener, you know, so carbon forks, carbon seat posts. It's a really great sort of linear vibration dampener. So this just saves a lot of weight. Looks very cool, which is part of the reason you get a custom bike.
It does look really cool.
And for a, you know, for a road bike, a custom road bike for someone, well, I'm not going to change height, so it can be all integrated. It can just be one piece. I'm not going to grow anymore, so I'm only ever going to shrink. I can just chop pieces off.
Well, I have to say, those fillet brazers on Rick's bike in the workshop were really, really beautiful. And I've never had a steel bike, but you're a steel bike man, aren't you, Tom?
Well, I think the bike that I, well, when I lived in London, certainly the bike that I used the most was a steel fixed gear. I, to be honest, I can't tell you, I'm not one of these riders who can really tell you the difference between how steel feels, how aluminium feels. I mean, I can tell you that they feel different, but I just don't have the sort of poetic verse to describe what those differences are. I did ride an amazing steel bike as well recently when I was in Girona. I rented one from our namesake, from Service Course, actually, the place out in Girona. It was a frame builder based in Barcelona called I think they're called Bell, and that bike, it was fantastic. It had SRAM E-Tap on it, but on an old school, very thin tubed steel frame. Beautiful. And it is the, like I said before, the next bike I get will be a steel custom build. And actually, they talk a lot about the thing about getting a bike built for you is not just the design, it's finding the right designer for you. And a lot of that is about just speaking to them. And actually, going back to when we spoke to Duncan earlier on, I've actually asked Duncan to do me some drawings because I just got a great vibe from him. You know, he's really into music. He's into a lot of stuff that I like. He's into some of the bike designs that I like. So it's about finding the right fit for you, the right person.
I couldn't agree more. And from my research, I think that, you know, being on the same wavelength as the bike builder who's going to build your bike, sitting down with them, having a cup of tea, talking about what you want, I think that is the most important thing, because you really need to understand each other. They need to understand what you want. You need to understand how they build bikes and what their end product is going to be. But then, okay, so if you actually want a custom fitted bike, what's the process and how does the maker go about making one for you? I had a chat with Rick about exactly that.
Well, yeah, that's the whole purpose of getting a custom bike, isn't it? It's something that fits you. It's your bike. So I have had a background in bike fit before. You know, I used to use sort of the retool system in shops and things like that. But essentially, I take a load of body measurements and we work that into the frame sizing. So, you know, if you've got particularly long arms, for example, you can have a longer top tube. Or if you've got, you know, a longer femur, perhaps we'll slacken the seat angle to accommodate that. So we work all the little measurements into the actual frame design itself, as against, you know, like an off-the-peg bike, where you would just buy an off-the-peg bike and then you would change things appropriately to try and get it to fit. The problem with that is you can't always, you know, like when I used to do bike fits, if someone had like a short leg, you'd have like a 54 frame, for example, but it might have like a long arm. So you'd be trying to replicate like a 56, 57 centimeter chop tube by putting a longer stem on, which would affect the way the bike handled and the geometry of the bike, and it would throw a few things out of kilt. The idea of a custom frame is you've got far more leeway to have a bike that fits and have the geometry that the customer wants.
So with that flexibility and customization that you're talking about, how can you then guarantee that you're going to have a good ride quality if you're kind of messing around with different geometries by adding a bit of length in the top tube or whatever? Or is it just something that you know from years of having...
Yeah, I mean, bikes? There's always compromising stuff, you know. You're never going to get everything. You know, when customers come in, it is a case of sort of, I won't say managing expectations, but, you know, you try your best to give them everything they want from a bike. But as you say, there's still limitations. Every time you change something, it's going to affect something else on the frame or the bike itself. So you just try, essentially ask as many questions as you can about what it's going to be used for and their sort of riding style. And again, the size of the customer and how often they're going to be using it and everything you possibly can, so you can iron out any
any little details you need to give them the best, you know, tick all the boxes you can. But there's always going to be compromise here and there.
But it sounds like, you know, at the end of the day, you're just going to get something that's specific to you and going to be the best possible fit you can get.
Precisely.
You just can't get that from a bike shop because, you know, no two people are the same. No two people have the same leg length and arm length or torso length.
No, exactly. Yeah, my arm length, for example, is 10 centimetres wider than my height, which is like I've got freakishly long arms. So
finding
exactly. So finding like a bike to feel like my bike's got a really long top tube. So finding a frame to fit me off the peg is quite difficult. And that's the same with everyone. Like you say, no two people are the same. And you can work around injuries and things
twins.
As well. Exactly, unless they're identical twins.
In which case you get 2-for-1 on bike building geometry.
Yeah, we'll do a discount there. Yeah.
So if you're taking something like a road bike, you've got one customer or you've got a pair of identical twins.
Okay.
And one wants a road bike and one wants a gravel bike.
Yeah.
What are we going to see in terms of differences in the frame build and in terms of kind of how does the tubing differ? How does the structure differ to kind of get one to be a super fast bike on the road and one to be a bike that still goes fast on the road, but it gives you compliance and that softness and, you know, a bit of play that you want from being on the gravel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I suppose you've got your road bike. The tolerances and sort of the frame itself is going to be very tight. So, you know, you're going to have very tight, sort of very short chain stays. You're going to have very tight sort of tyre clearance. The geometry itself, you're going to have sort of steep seat tube angle and a fairly steep head tube angle. When you start wanting to use it as a gravel bike, you need more tyre clearance. So you'd have sort of a wider back end, longer back end, a longer sort of more slacker front end because you'll be going faster over rougher terrain, so it'll just sort of slacken out a little bit more, perhaps along a head tube as well. And that sort of geometry wise, you're only changing things maybe by a few degrees, a few centimetres, but it can make a big effect on the whole bike.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast and Service Course. You can get 25% off your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. Science in Sport launched a new product this week, a performance nitrate range formulated to deliver effective doses of dietary nitrates to support loading, pre-exercise and intra-exercise usage. The key performance benefit is that nitrates improve muscle efficiency by reducing the oxygen cost of exercise and maximising endurance performance, enabling athletes to go harder for longer. The SIS Performance Nitrate range includes gels, bars, powders, shots, and use rhubarb juice concentrate and amaranthus leaf extract as unique sources of nitrates, providing a superior taste profile and delivering a higher nitrate dose compared to anything else on the market. Supplementing with nitrates can improve running economy or cycling efficiency by reducing the oxygen cost of exercise. For more information on the performance nitrate range, see scienceinsport.com. And remember, you can get 25% off your Science in Sport order with the code SISCP25.
So finally, I mean, a lot of people use custom steel bikes because they want a touring bike, and mm-hmm. so with that they often want a lot of load. Mm-hmm. So one thing I want to know is, how do you incorporate this ability to take large amounts of load into the frames and the structure of the seat stays and things like that?
Yeah, well, like we're talking about before, the different types of steel and the button, you just use a slightly heavier gauge of tubing that can manage the loads. And when you're trying to add eyelets and, you know, places where you want to mount things to, you don't want it going into a piece of tubing that's like 0.4 of a mil thick if you want to add 20 kilos of weight to it swinging around. But that is one of the beauties of steel, again, is you can add mounts. We've made all sorts of crazy bikes, crazy touring bikes, bike packing bikes, very specific bits of kit built around specific dynamo hubs or electronic systems, and these can all be routed through the frame in almost an infinite way. Something you just cannot, again, get off the shelf. You know, if someone has an idea in their head and they're doing the Trans-American bike ride and they want, you know, specific dynamo routings and charging points and lights and panniers and or specific bags added into the frame,
we can build all that in. We can build it around all these things. We can add the mounting points wherever they want. So you get a lot more or less sort of retrofitted items on a custom bike. You know, you're not having to strap and bodge as many things. You can intrinsically build into the bike itself. So yeah, when you're talking about loads and things, you just use, you know, like a heavier gauge tubing and work around that. You know, you ask them what they're doing with it, and then we use the tubing and our knowledge to build it for them.
That's really interesting. I've been actually doing a lot of reading recently about the Transcon, and I went to see a film about the Transcontinental as well. And it's something that I think that, you know, after my racing career, I would love to do some... Well, I think I would love to do these competitions. Perhaps when I start actually having a go, I would realise that the people who do them are just bonkers.
Yeah. And type 2 pleasure.
Yeah, definitely. But, I mean, looking at some of the bikes, like you were saying, about the Dynamo, you've got to have everything specific to what you need. You have got to have loads of charging points, although it sounds a bit ridiculous. Like, you do need lights, you do need routing devices. You need to be able to charge your tracker and things like that. And I never really understood how these things worked. And I was thinking, oh yeah, you've got your dynamo hub, you're going to have like wires going everywhere. But the idea of having a beautifully integrated system that enables you to ride more aero, more comfortably, and you know, all of these things, it can just really add to the feeling and the excitement, and I just think it's really cool.
And it's built to last as well, isn't it? You know, you invest in a steel frame, it's built to fit you, and you look after it, it will last a lifetime. It's not a disposable item. You know, we live in this culture now where new frames, new bikes come out every year, and there must be piles and piles and piles of carbon frames just getting thrown about that aren't built to last. That, you know, it shouldn't be a disposable item, a bike frame. If you have a frame built that fits you, then why not look after it? Why not keep it for life? And the idea of steel is it's a very affordable way of doing that as well. It's so manipulative in what you can do with it, and you can create so many things for not a lot of money and not a huge sort of setup. You know, anyone can have a steel frame. And it can be built for almost any purpose. As before, we had my hill climb bike, weighs 5.6 kilos, I think, so it's not by no means a heavy material anymore. We've built race running trikes for world champion para athletes. We've done all sorts with steel tubing that you perhaps can't do with a lot of the other materials out there. So it's a real go-to material, and I think it's having a resurgence at the minute.
A bike is for life, not just for Christmas.
A bike is for life, not just for
Christmas. A steel bike is for life, not just for
Christmas. Well, if you want one for Christmas, then put your orders in now.
If there is an instance in which there is a damage to a steel frame, say in a crash or something, is it possible to repair it?
Yeah, almost like, you know, 99% of the time it's repairable and not. You know, if you damage a tube, crack it, you can replace whole tubes on bikes, you can replace any part of the bike, you can pretty much replace on a steel bike. And that, again, is one of the beauties of it. You can repair it. That's why it is such a long-lived material. If it corrodes, you crack it, you crash it, you bend it, you ding it. Yeah, you can fix it.
I can imagine being halfway through the Transcon and, oh, God, in the middle of Turkey or something, and then you crash your bike, you crack it, and then you go and find some weld somewhere
and just get it welded back on, and then
you carry on again. And that's the beauty of it, isn't it?
Whereas, like, you know, perhaps carbon becomes... It can be repaired, but becomes more difficult to repair. And, you know, it becomes very expensive to repair, and it can also be damaged without any visible sort of marks on it. It can delaminate from the inside. Aluminium can be repaired, but once you've welded it, it sort of jeopardizes the area around it and weakens it. And aluminium itself sort of works, hardens over the time, and fatigues differently to steel. And titanium is a whole other world that people say they can repair and build, but it's very expensive and very difficult to work with. Steel sort of brings together a lot of good qualities of all the other materials, and it will last.
I think that is one of the lasting beauties of steel, and is the fact that it lasts. You know, it has amazing longevity. If there's a problem, you can just get it fixed. And at the end of the day, we live in this crazy disposable world where even something like a bike frame. You have it for a few years and then maybe you crash it, maybe you fancy something else. That's not how it is with a steel frame. A steel frame, you keep it, you treasure it, and you love it, and if something's wrong, you can fix it. I also wanted to learn about titanium building, and it's not something that we've covered in this episode, but in the world of bespoke bikes, it's something that's revered. It's a very, very special product, a very expensive product. So while I was down at Cycles in Motion, I ended up having a really interesting chat with Dan, the other bike builder there, about titanium. And let's just say the conversation didn't quite go where I was expecting.
Bar it being horribly expensive, far too difficult to work with, it's just not very reliable. It rides horribly. Well, it rides okay, but it doesn't ride as nice as a steel frame, and it's not as stiff as aluminium, and it's not as cheap. So you're stuck with this material that you have to purge a room or the area you're working with argon, which is a rare gas anyway, to do a proper job. It just doesn't seem like it's worth it. You know, like titanium bolts, brilliant, but like if you think about the price of a titanium bolt, it costs you £4 for one, and then you pick up a titanium frame for £600. It's tricky, man. It's a tricky material to work with. It's the welding conditions more than anything else, and that is just too expensive to even comprehend doing properly.
So what is it exactly? How exactly do you have to weld titanium, then?
You have to do it in a room that's been purged of its oxygen, and the oxygen's replaced with argon. I hope I'm right. But, yeah, as far as I know, you have to purge the room of oxygen and the working area you're working in with argon, and to do it properly, that's horribly expensive process. Having a gas sealed room or a gas sealed box on its own is expensive, let alone the potentially 100 litres of argon you've got to pump into it, which isn't cheap. So yeah, titanium, wonderful material, done right. Like anything, it's like a carbon frame, done right, absolutely, it should last you a lifetime. But the 90% of the frames we see cracked are carbon and titanium, because they've not been built right. They've been built to a budget. They've been built, you know, not to last.
Cheap.
Yeah, they've been built cheap, like to sell, you know. A friend of mine had a titanium bike made, and this guy is like, was he Ken Erickson out in America? I think it cost him £4,800 for the frame, which is a lot of money for a frame, you know, a 29 of bike packing frame with one bottle cage on it. You know, that's a lot of money. But that's the sort of money you're looking at. And he does a proper job, but there isn't many in the world that do, that you could really put your name to and say that's a fantastic piece of engineering.
So the compromise that you make without using an argon-filled room, is that you
you get impurities building up in the material. So the material will, when you melt materials, the impurities rise to the top, and like the idea, and they start to oxidize if there's oxygen in the room. So you have to remove the oxygen so the material doesn't oxidize inside the weld or behind it or around it or whatever. It's a tricky, nightmarish process.
So without that real proper setup,
and there's no point. You know, like it's a wonderful material for the right purpose, like bolts, axles, things that have been machined from a billet, absolutely fantastic, because there's been no heat build up. You don't need a ergon parge room, you just need a 1950s lathe and some cutting bits, and you can make things out of titanium. Whereas, yeah, trying to weld it, that's another story, that's a whole different kettle of fish, which I haven't either got the money or the experience to go down that line. So it's a nice thing, but it's not worth the money. Not worth what they come up as, you know, like £4,000 for a frame set. That's ridiculous, man. Just buy a steel one, and then when you crash it, at least you can repair it, not go, oh, I've broken my titanium frame. That's £4,000 in the bin. Same as carbon, man. You know, if you don't get your bikes for free, and then you go and pay £4,500 for a frame set, and then you have a crash on it and you crack it, it's gone. And it's not going to be recycled. It's not going, I don't know, to a second-hand shop. It's not going to the kids in Africa. That thing's going into landfill.
Or the sea.
They are so polluting, and they're great for a racer, you know, but standard, you've got to do it right. And that's why you pay so much money for a really, really good carbon frame, but they are all designed to be too light.
I have to say, I was actually looking for a new frame for my husband recently, and I was shocked to see how expensive carbon frames were.
Yeah.
And now talking to you guys about the process of making steel frames and, you know, the fact that you can get a custom, specific custom bike purposefully for you for a snip of the price of, you know, a really good carbon frame now, it's quite eye-opening, because I think in the last 5 years since I bought my first carbon bike, honestly, prices have tripled or quadrupled. It's crazy.
It's more expensive than motorsport now. The parts are insane. Like, frames are, you know, more expensive than most people's cars. You know, it's absolutely insane. And they're not done with care. There's no care and attention that's gone. Once you've made a carbon fibre mould, you just need people to shove carbon into it. And yeah, it's skilled, but they're cheap to produce once you've made that mould. Because carbon's not an expensive material. Like, rolls of carbon isn't that expensive as a material. And the resin isn't that, it's a boxy glue, you know, like you can buy it in B&Q. It's not expensive. But yet you pay a lot of money for a disposable item. It makes no sense. It would be like buying a chain ring that cost you £600.
Well, that is a pretty convincing argument for steel there, I would say. And I don't know about you, but I'm definitely won over. I'm already planning my post-retirement, all singing, all dancing, dynamo-hubbed, built-in lights, transcontinental adventure bike in steel. What about you, Tom? What are you going to go for?
Well, actually, Lizzie, I can actually picture that already. That suits you down to a T, that. My next bike, you know, I'm toying with having a custom build. And what I'm actually going for at the moment is I want a single speed, fixed gear, thin tubes, deep but really deep section wheels as well. Sort of classic look, but then with a really modern cockpit. So, I mean, and this is why you need a builder, right? Because, you know, you have these ideas and they sound just crazy when you say them out loud, but like a good builder, or, you know, someone you've got a good fit with, can interpret that and turn it into your dream, you know?
I do think the one thing that you're forgetting, Tom, about your dream single speed build is that you live in Glossop on the edge of the Peak District, and I do not know how you're going to get up those hills.
No, well, this is the one I used to go to Manchester, you see, so it's like over one hill and then you're downhill all the way to Manchester. It's all right. It's just the coming back that's the hard
bit. So you're going to have a custom commuter bike and then another custom bike for the hills.
Yeah, as you said, the thing is, I think we're going to have like I wouldn't even call it a commuter bike. I'd call it more like a sort of posy, quite pretentious bike. I want the most pretentious bike I can find.
So you're going to get a titanium bike then?
Well, do you know what? I mean, it's funny, you know, you talk about titanium, right? And do you know what? We don't go more than 3 episodes of this show without someone attacking titanium and having a go at it. And I know it's hard to work with. And I know from when we spoke to Rob Hales, like, it doesn't handle that great as a bike material. You know, it doesn't corner as well, people say. That's my excuse anyway. But I ride a titanium bike. My sort of training bike, or the bike that I do the most miles on, is a titanium bike, a Lightspeed. And I absolutely adore it. I think I probably forgive it a lot because it looks great. That may be, you know, why I forgive it so much. But yeah, I absolutely adore titanium. And it's, you know, I just, like I say, I don't really, I'm not a builder, so I don't, you know, I don't care about how hard it is to work with. But I just think it looks great, and it does feel great, and it's really forgiving. That's one thing I can say about that material. Like, on the roads that we ride around in the Peak District, compared to carbon, it is a little bit more comfortable, I think.
Well, I think I forgot to say, or decided not to say at the top of the show, because I would have put you all off and you'd have probably just switched off straight away, that I'm really not very qualified to talk about this topic, because, to be honest, I've never ridden a steel frame, I've never ridden a titanium frame, and so what I see are these beautiful images, but I don't know what it feels like to ride these bikes. So really I need to borrow someone's titanium frame, borrow someone's steel frame, and kind of go and do a set route and try them all out, because I love the look of these bikes, but I don't think I'm qualified to understand the differences in ride feel.
Well, Lizzie, thanks for that. Always great spending time with you. We will be back next month. I do have to warn you that we are in the danger zone for me next month because my baby's due.
Eek!
So, my thoughts exactly. So hopefully I'll be here, but who knows?
Yeah, so I mean, you might be really, really unlucky next month and we might be doing a service course with me and Richard. Who knows?
No, not so, you can't have Rich, not with some of the questions he asks on the thread.
No, he's got no idea. Don't worry, I'll pin Tom down. We'll get it in before the baby arrives.
Thanks, Lizzie. I'll see you next month.
See you next month.
This episode of Service Course was produced by me. Our theme music is Beyond the Black Veil by the brilliant Moscow Youth Cult. Do go and check them out. And the rest of the tracks in the show come via Epidemic Sound. For details of the individual tracks, then please check the show notes. Thanks again.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.